With this strong back and soft front, there's space in between, space for the breath, space for the heart, space for the mind, the awareness, to turn inwards, sensing this inner nobility and integrity. Remembering why you're here today. Is there an intention for your practice this morning? Or perhaps beyond this morning? Just notice. Remembering this beautiful invocation to practice. O nobly born, you who are the sons and daughters of the awakened ones, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, remember who you are, the luminous mind, the goodness of your heart. Trust it, return to it. It is home. Good morning again, everybody. I am happy, so happy to see you. Okay. I love those instructions, those few instructions, O nobly born, to remember to tap into the goodness that you are, the possibility that you can remember that it's who you are, it's who we are. And I love that instruction of holding enough energy in the back body to stay upright and awake and letting everything else relax so there's room to breathe. Because both of those things set a certain posture, the posture of the mind, heart, of remembering our inner beauty, our inner goodness, and the physical posture of coming to this time with a quality of some uprightness. There's an integrity and an indignity that happens when we come into this posture of meditation, holding the awareness with this kind presence. And I think that the posture of the mind and the posture of the heart and the posture of the body actually reflect the postures of our lives. And I want to talk about that today as we go forward, is these qualities of inner innate and inner nobility, compassion, and how that relates to what we do in our lives every day, how that is a foundation. So this quality about strong back, soft front, we could take that and apply it to everything that we do. There is a strength of back which can be thought of as the equanimity, the ability to be just right here. And the soft front, willing, open. There's a willingness to all of it, but in a soft front, It's not about not having boundaries. It's not about being vulnerable in ways that isn't right for you. But it is about a curiosity. It's about a willingness. It's this presence. So I love that. I use that all the time in my own practice, a literal sense of strong back, soft front. And then I think in the middle of that, I can breathe and my heart is, there's a freedom of heart that happens within that because there's a holding, there's that structure, a foundation that's in place. And then this sati, sati, the Pali word that's often translated as mindfulness. I like to just say sati and not need to translate it necessarily. This soft receptivity of mind. I learned that from Bhikkhu Anālayo, that's the translation that he offers. And when my mind is soft and receptive, it can accommodate a lot more. You know, it doesn't have that rigidity of whatever might be going on, any kind of rejection. It's much more equanimous. And that, out of that soft receptivity of mind, an intention has more space to arise. And you know how intentions work. Sometimes there's more than one or a consistent one. There might be an intention that is the overarching intention that you have for your life, inside of work, outside of work, for family, for all the different roles that we have. But there might be just an overall larger intention. And then there are smaller intentions that arise. So when sati is present, there's space and my intention can arise. And then I know where to place my attention. And I, last time I was here, I relayed a story that I heard from Tara Brach that has really stayed with me. And it was a story of, it's just worth telling you again, of about 20 years ago when she was in a lineup of six people on a panel to talk about what is the essential teaching from the Buddha. And she was the only woman of six people, and she was set to go second, and she was happy that she was second in line, so it didn't give her too much time to get too nervous about waiting for her turn. So the first person who went was Roshi Baker from San Francisco Zen Center, Richard Baker, and he came up to the podium and he put his hands together and he said, "The key to freedom is intention and attention." And then he bowed and he walked off the stage. That was it. And what Tara says about it is, "Oh my God, I have no idea what I said, but that wasn't 10 minutes. And so what she wanted to say when she went up there was, like he said, just like he said. So, you know, you think about all of these teachings that we get, and we can bring in all of these different teachers, and we're all pretty much saying, yeah, like he said, like she said, like they said, like the Buddha said. But I love that piece of the key to freedom is intention and attention. So what do we bring with us? What are we paying attention to? And in that short arriving meditation, it just guided us through the coming to our senses, the sense of touch, sight, sound, taste, smell, the state of heart, the state of mind. And if you really do that, if you really bring your attention to each one of those things, it's a very quick and effective way of becoming very present. Have you ever noticed that? You know, if you really are attending to the senses, you don't think about anything else. Well, you might have a few tracks going, but truly being with sound is just being with sound, or being with touch, etc. So this soft receptivity of mind, this sati, makes space for the intention to arise, enough energy to attend, to point the attention. And then there's some heartfulness, some attitude that comes out of that. So this is why I like to begin with posture. The posture, the inner posture as expresses on the outer posture, but this whole posture together then shows up in our lives in many different ways. It's not just the physical posture. So I want to talk a little bit today. We're going to talk about this innate nobility and interconnected compassion and wise livelihood, one of the key components in the Noble Eightfold Path. Although I think that wise livelihood probably doesn't get as much attention as some of the other path factors. So I want to talk about that today. And in the Abhidhamma, which is the study of Buddhist psychology, the very first principle says, we must see the inner nobility of and beauty of all beings. To see the inner nobility of all beings. And this includes ourselves. And I think as we are all in the continual and what might feel like relentless challenges that are happening in our culture and everywhere, it can be hard to see the inner nobility and goodness and beauty of all beings. We're challenged by that, I think, all the time, you know, in the face of turmoil, in the face of violence that is unimaginable and very hard to reconcile. How do we do it? And I don't come to you with the answer. This is one of these things that we take these teachings and chew on it and work with it. So this posture of nobility and dignity, uprightness of the mind and body, that brings a certain presence, a certain willingness, and with it, a certain vulnerability. And when I say vulnerability, I don't mean an overly emotionally exposed place. I mean, there's some balance in it, inherent in curiosity and willingness and openness is a quality of vulnerability. But I also am very aware that in using that word, that I'm not suggesting that any of us open ourselves to a place that would be harmful to us. So keeping in mind that balance. So as we sit literally, if you're in a sitting posture or whatever your meditation posture is, can you sit with a certain strength, a certain, there's an integrity, there's a certain dignity and nobility in there. That sense of, I have a right to be here. You know, that was one of the key things that the Buddha said in his awakening, sitting under the Bodhi tree as Mara, the tempter, the voice of doubt, that inner critic, kept coming and saying, you don't really want to do this. Why do you think you have the right to awaken? You know, and his response was to put his hand on the right hand on the earth and say, I have a right to be here. We all have a right to be here. And we come with this dignity, with this nobility. So that connects to how does the posture, the physical posture, the posture of the mind, the posture of our body, how does that become the whole posture of our lives? What do we bring? How do we want to show up? How do we spend our time? I just got back from a week of river rafting in Colorado and in Utah. And it was a lot of fun. And it's a retreat that I teach where we combine a river rafting trip with, I overlay a meditation retreat into it. And it is really a place to practice. How do we show up? How do we deal with adversity? How does fun happen? How do we bring our presence, our whole hearts and minds to the whole thing, especially when one is out in the wild and you can't just say, okay, time's up, I'm going home now. Can't do that. And so the first 2 days was freezing cold and raining, just freezing cold and raining. And when you're out in the wilds and that's what it is, you just got to deal. You know, you just got to deal. And we went through these first rapids and it started to hail. I kid you not. I mean, here we are, 20 of us, and it's hailing and it is cold. And I knew it was going to be like that. I realized that, a couple of days in advance with the weather forecast. And I've been on river trips before where I have been so cold the entire time. And I had a little bit of PTSD about, oh my God, I'm going back into another river trip and I'm going to try to give Dharma talks and teach meditation while I myself am really super cold and uncomfortable. So it's the epitome of working with the Vedanas, right? That pleasant, unpleasant, comfortable, uncomfortable, liking, not liking. I wanted it like this, not like that, but it's like this. So how do you show up with this inner nobility, right? And the challenge of all of that. And, it was a beautiful trip. And after the first 2 days, there were no weather challenges. And even in that, I sometimes hear myself say when I'm here or in other places, being in an argument with the weather is a really big waste of time. And it really is, except that it's really hard. So it was a great, great practice opportunity to still find that ability to say truly, right now it is like this. This is how it is. And so we can hear all these different Dharma adages. It's not what I wanted, but it's what I've got. Right now it's like this. Well, truly, that's the place to practice those things when you are in the midst of that storm, and you got to find your balance in the rapids. And it is a really beautiful, phenomenal, beautiful place to bring practice. And the wildlife was gorgeous, and the canyon walls are beautiful, and all of that stuff happens. And here is this solid earth, these ancient, up to the exposed rock of almost 2 billion years old. And you're thinking about what have these rocks and these canyon walls weathered and seen, and they're still here. They're still here. I can do that too. And there's this quality of continuing just to show up. We just show up and do the best we can. So here's a story that I love, and then we'll move into our longer meditation. This comes from Jan Chosen Bays, who is a Zen priest. She's in Oregon. And this is from her book called The Vow-Powered Life, all about how do you stick with whatever is happening? How do you just keep at it? Here's the story. In 1666, the Great Fire destroyed 80% of the homes in London. St. Paul's Cathedral, built in the 11th century, over 160 years, was destroyed. The great architect Christopher Wren was hired to rebuild the cathedral. Work started in 1669 when Wren was 37 years old, and the first service was held in the church when he was 65. He received the second half of his promised salary at age 79 when the church was completed. Who among us would have a vow powerful enough to continue working on a project for 32 years at half salary? There's an interesting story from the time of the rebuilding of St. Paul's. One morning, Wren, who was not personally known by many of the workers, stopped and asked three different laborers, all engaged in the same task, what they were doing. The first said, "I'm cutting this stone." The second answered, "I'm earning 3 shillings sixpence a day." And the third man straightened up, squared his shoulders, still holding his mallet and chisel, replied, "I'm helping Sir Christopher Wren build this great cathedral." So that's nobility and presence and showing up, right? Sitting with strength, this dignity, this thing of, I am going to stick with this. I have a right to be here. I'm becoming connected, part of something bigger than ourselves. And that's how I felt in these canyons. How I am so little. I am just such a speck, but my presence matters and everybody else's presence mattered. And we did this thing together for a week in partially really trying conditions, and it required everybody to show up. Everybody was important. And with this quality of sati, this open receptivity of mind that was able to be there in this magnificent beauty, no matter what, no matter what. And so we show up with a quality of no matter whatness. I think that's part of what our practice also teaches and helps us get to, that even when we rail against, it's like this and I don't want it to be like this, I definitely didn't want to be that cold. Okay, put more clothes on. You know, I was grateful to the guides who had extra warm things. And so that's how we show up and do it together also. So I love that story of Sir Christopher Wren. I'm helping Sir Christopher Wren build this great cathedral, and that he could do this over so many years and stick with it. That is an inner nobility. So let's move into our meditation. We'll sit for about a half an hour. So again, finding a posture that truly supports your body, whether, again, feel free to sit or stand or walk or recline, eyes open or closed, whichever you prefer. Sensing the body connected to the earth, touching itself, this groundedness of the body, the rightness of being right here. Again, sensing how the spine grows tall out of the deep low back all the way to the crown of the head, holding just enough energy to invite this strong back, this uprightness, this inner nobility, and the soft front, relaxing the muscles of the face, the throat, the chest and the belly, making space for the mind to turn the awareness inward, for the heart to open, for the breath to move, and finding that place where you can settle your own attention. Whether it's right where you feel the breath the most, in the body, belly, chest, nostrils, wherever it is. Or if the breath isn't the place for you, perhaps the touch of the feet, or the seat, or the hands, a place in the body that feels comfortable to rest. So as you settle in to this place where you can anchor your awareness, know that the mind will drift off. And when you notice the drift, just, you might say, mind wandering, thinking, whatever it is, and then come back to that place, to that anchor, and begin again, gently, letting the sati arise, settling in. O nobly born, you who are the sons and daughters of the awakened ones, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, remember who you are, the luminous mind, the goodness of your heart. Trust it. Return to it. It is home. And let's sit quietly. Thank you. If there's any holding in the body, the jaw, the shoulders, anywhere, softening as you can, releasing any tension that you can. from wherever you are, getting a sense of the inner posture. What is the state of mind and heart, even the state of spirit? What is this inner attitude, attention, what's happening in this posture? Not with judgment, just noticing however it is. How's the external posture? Is there still a sense of the strength of the back body, the softness of the front? Perhaps the back body is the equanimity, the front body is the compassion, the sati. Becoming attentive to this inner and outer posture. And now, if you like, drawing the awareness into the heart space, however you sense your own space of the heart, perhaps the heart center, sensing in, if you like, even placing a hand or two on the chest, to get a sense of the warmth of your own body touching itself, waking up the heart a little more. And coming into the heart's breath. This is an option, if you like. Imagine every time you breathe in, drawing in fresh energy, fresh breath from every direction into the heart space, nurturing the heart from above and below, the back and the front, the diagonals and the sides. Drawing in, breathing in this nurturing energy and breath into the heart space. And as you breathe out, back out into every direction, letting the heart soften and relax, perhaps becoming a little more spacious, stable. Try this for a few rounds of breath, breathing in and out of this heart space. Sensing this inner and innate nobility. The strength and softness that exist together. And I'll offer you some phrases for a compassion practice this morning, similar to metta. And if it's possible to offer this to yourself, do that. If it feels more accessible to you to offer these phrases to another being, any being in your life, do that. Whichever feels right this morning. May I accept myself just as I am, right in this moment. May you accept yourself just as you are right in this moment. May I surround my limitations and challenges with respect, care, and love. May you do the same. May I be supported with strength, steadiness, and courage. May you be supported with strength, steadiness, and courage. And together may we rest in the beauty and goodness of our awakening hearts. May we rest in the beauty and goodness of our awakening hearts. And we'll end this meditation with a poem called What You Missed That Day You Were Absent from Fourth Grade by Brad Aaron Modlin. Mrs. Nelson explained how to stand still and listen to the wind, how to find meaning in pumping gas, how peeling potatoes can be a form of prayer. She took questions on how not to feel lost in the dark. After lunch, she distributed worksheets that covered ways to remember your grandfather's voice. Then the class discussed falling asleep without feeling you had forgotten to do something else, something important, and how to believe the house you wake in is your home. This prompted Mrs. Nelson to draw a chalkboard diagram detailing how to chant the Psalms during cigarette breaks and how not to squirm for sound when your own thoughts are all you hear. Also, that you have enough. The English lesson was that I am is a complete sentence. And just before the afternoon bell, she made the math equation look easy, the one that proves that hundreds of questions and feeling cold and all those nights spent looking for whatever it lost, you lost, and one person add up to something. The one that proves that hundreds of questions and feeling cold and all those nights spent looking for whatever it was you lost and one person add up to something. Thank you, everybody. Let's take 5 minutes, take a break, and we'll see you at 7 or 8 minutes after the hour. Thank you. So I want to continue on this topic of touching in and cultivating this innate nobility and knowing that it is innate. It is inside of us. How do we bring compassion? And I'm thinking about interconnected compassion into our lives. And how does that relate to the path factor of wise livelihood? So here we go. This first principle of the Abhidhamma, to see the inner nobility and beauty of all beings, including ourselves. We've talked a lot about that. And the second one says that compassion is our deepest nature. Compassion is our deepest nature. It arises from our interconnection with all things. And you know, sometimes this piece of what is interconnection, it really is that everything happens because everything else happens. Nothing lives or can be fully in isolation to anything else. This is the study of karma, of action. One thing leads to the next, to the next, to the next. And it's in big ways and it's in small ways. And I think that when we truly experience how my well-being is really wrapped up in your well-being and vice versa, that compassion does arise because we want to show up. We want to be helpful. If you think about sometimes the traditional definition of compassion in our practices, when love meets pain, compassion arises. And sometimes it's fierce compassion. I have to really take a stand about something. But to understand that because everything is so connected with everything else, how can there be any other response other than, oh my, I really want to show up and do well. I really want to be kind. I really want that back. I want to be part of a caring community. Nancy Wood, who is a writer in her writing on connections, she says, every time we take a breath, we become the universe. The very moment of creation is contained in us and passes onto rocks and trees and animals and fish. The old ones say the essence of life is in water and wind, earth and breath, fire and bone, but most of all in breath, our first connection to the elk, the hawk, the bear, and the buffalo. Without breath, no connection. Without connection, no creation. Without creation, no breath. This is the sacred circle of life, unbroken. It's easy to forget You know, it's easy to forget how connected every single thing is with every other thing. So in December 1968, that's when Apollo 8 went up into space, and we got the first photo of the Earth from space. Do you remember that photo? It's called Earthrise. And it was an amazing, life-changing photograph because we had never seen what the Earth actually looks like, this blue planet that is mostly water. And interestingly, the Earthrise photo, discovering the Earth from that perspective, gave rise to the Gaia theory in the 70s. And the Gaia theory says that Earth functions as a self-regulating living system, that the Earth is actually a living being, a self-regulating living being, of which we are an integral component, not just beings living on Earth, but part of its regulatory system. That we are an integral part of the living Earth, part of each other, that we are of the Earth literally. And we can see this, right? We can see this in the dysregulation of the climate, that we are part of it, that we have contributed to this greatly. How do these elements of water, air, heat, fire, mineral, stardust, oxygen, carbon dioxide exchange, all of these things are alive, and we are alive with it. So what we do and what we think, how we are in our lives, it really matters. It really matters. And I was listening to somebody talk about the importance of traditional ecological knowledge, indigenous cultures, what they know that we don't necessarily know about the importance of this knowledge, and that even the language of natural resources that is so woven into our lexicon, the natural resources, to think about the Earth as a resource is technically something to be used, right? Or we think about, can resources be repurposed, or can they be replenished? Maybe not. So what if we think about the Earth as not a resource, but the source of life? And how do we take care of that? And this is this piece of compassion. Compassion arises out of the interconnectedness of all beings. This second principle of the Abhidhamma, compassion is our deepest nature. It arises from the awareness of our interconnection with everything. And so we come into this thing that I think, or this, it's not even a concept, I think it's what's true, is this sense of a radical interconnectedness. And when I say that, I don't mean extremist. You know, the word radical, there are different ways to think about that word, but I mean from the root, total and complete interconnectedness. And when we really truly understand that, how this reciprocal relationship works of me to you and you to me and all of us with each other and with the Earth, that's when we start to have such a deep compassion and, I hope, intense motivation to take really good care of each other and ourselves and the Earth. And that's what happens on these, when I teach nature retreats. This is what we're doing. We are connecting with ourselves and each other and the Earth and the natural world. So we deepen this love. So we are inspired to take really good care. Pema Chodron, she says, what you do for yourself, any gesture of kindness, any gesture of gentleness, any gesture of honesty and clear seeing towards yourself will affect how you experience your world. In fact, it'll transform how you experience your world. What you do for yourself, you're doing for others. And what you're doing for others, you're doing for yourself. Sometimes it can be hard to see that, but it's true. There's so many ripple effects from our own actions and the ripple effects we feel from the actions of others. We're all in this together. It's just completely interwoven. Compassion is our deepest nature. It arises from our interconnection with all things. So why does it matter? You know, coming back to this piece of why it matters, who am I? Who are you? So in the context of both of these principles of the Abhidhamma, to see the inner nobility and beauty of all beings, to understand our interconnection, that's how we can connect that to wise livelihood. And when I talk about wise livelihood as a path factor, you know, traditionally the Buddha taught this as what was okay to do for a living, to make money, to support yourself and your family, and what was not okay. And he taught it as initially to monastics, but we adapt this to our lives as primarily as lay practitioners. So my own story, I just thought I would take a few minutes and just tell you a little bit about my own background around livelihood and what I was learning and all along the way and how I've ended up here, because I like to make this real. This is not just some idea, but you can think about it for yourself. How did you come to be where you are and how you are at this moment in time? No matter what your work or non-work is, whether you are working for a living, whether you're not, but mostly this is, how do you spend your time? What do you do each day? So I started out out of college as a nurse, and I was 22 years old, and I was completely ill-prepared for what I saw and what I experienced. Death and dying and illness and trauma. I was seeing how people get hurt, how they hurt each other, even in the context of healing. And I was way too young for what I was doing. And I think about young nurses now, or just younger people now, being exposed to everything we're exposed to, the daily traumas, the illnesses, the sicknesses, everything that happens. And it's one thing to train technically for a profession, but in my experience, there was less than zero support for the spirit or the heart about how do we manage the trauma that we were seeing and working with every single day. And I haven't been involved in hospital nursing now for many years, but my hunch is that maybe it hasn't come as far as I would like it to, because how do we take care of ourselves in the face of such pain? And it was also a toxic environment. You know, during that time, this is 40 years ago, literally, there was such a hierarchy, there's such a patriarchy of who got what and who was listened to, the difference between men and women and doctors and nurses and all of the hospital politics. And again, I don't know how it is now, but during that time, I felt it. I felt the lack of compassion, the lack of inclusivity. There was so much exclusivity. So that's where I started out as a young adult. And I didn't last very long in it. I lasted about 5 years, and it was a painful time. And I remember coming home from work one day, and my husband said to me, you know, you don't have to do this. You know, you don't have to do this. I'll never forget it, because it was a moment of, you mean I have a choice? I don't have to stay in a job that is destroying my heart. And I was so exhausted, and we had tiny little kids. And that was a first, I bring it up because it was a moment of awareness where things shifted for me. And so much of mindfulness, I think, is about choice. What is happening? Does it support my well-being, or does it increase my suffering? And it was truly increasing my suffering. And it was so helpful to have my husband say, you don't have to. Right. And if we come to Tony Bernhard's definition of how he describes the Bay Area teacher, how he describes the Four Noble Truths, difficulty happens. We tend to make it worse. We don't have to. And here's how. So I was in this difficult situation that by not seeing that I had a choice, I was making worse for myself because I was so locked in. And by my conditioning, by core limiting beliefs, you go to school, you learn to do this thing and you do it and then you do it. Never mind if you like it or not. Never mind if it's destroying your heart or not. So being given that loving permission, you know, you don't have to do this, was an enormous gift. And I offer that because what are the things that each one of us might currently do that we don't have to do, that we're just doing out of routine, that we're doing out of conditioning, or out of, it's because I've always done it like this. You know, and our practice, I think, gives us the courage to say, wait a minute, is this working or is it not working? And being attentive to that. So then I started a business where I had a small job placement company where I helped nurse practitioners and physician assistants get jobs all over California. And it was very gratifying because I was basically a matchmaker. And it was a lot of fun to help people in a way that was felt to me that was truly helpful. And also it was not destroying my heart. It just wasn't. And I was able to then make a shift to working with my own schedule and being able to be the mother of young, very young children, and also work in a way that was supporting my family, but not just supporting my family in a financial way, but supporting my family in all ways, because I was more supported and I felt good about the work that I was doing. There's a lot of fun to bring people together for mutual benefit. You know, if you have ever had that opportunity to bring people together for mutual care and benefit, and I think that's what we do here, right? We come together for mutual benefit because it supports our lives. And then after 10 years, I sold that business and I went into the laundry business, and I had a laundromat for 20 years. All this time doing my practice, learning, you know, really getting involved in meditation and the Dharma, and creating a community. And when my business partner and I started that laundromat, our guiding mission statement was to create a place where people could do their laundry, where people could work, that was clean and dignified and safe, respectful place to be. And we never wavered an iota from that. And it was truly a delight to create a business that was a community hub that was safe and respectful and actually fun. It was actually a lot of fun, and it provided jobs, and it was really an expression. It was what brought out that, like, how can I work in a way that is a posture of mind and heart and body that actually also supported my family? And I say this full well knowing not everybody has the opportunity to create something out of nothing. And not everybody has an entrepreneurial mind. I do. But it was a really exciting time, and it was a wonderful way to work. It really was. And it was a piece of wise livelihood. Now, I want to bring in a piece here that I think is important. Where I live in Humboldt County, which is Arcata, California, 300 miles north of San Francisco. It's a very beautiful rural place on the coast. And it is also well known for the whole cannabis industry for many, 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 many years. And that's just not been a part of my life. And not because I have judgment about it, it's just not been a part of my life. And for a very long time, I really felt like in our part of my business model with keeping things honest and respectful and safe and not doing harm, that I took some pride, I would say, in not being part of the cannabis world. And over time, I started seeing how our business was affected by the cycle of when the harvest of the marijuana happened, and that we got a lot busier, our sales went way up. And because there were more people in town, all related to this business. And I still had this denial that I was in any way connected to that industry. And one day, as I was looking at what was happening in the trends of the business, it finally dawned on me that I was kidding myself. I was totally kidding myself that if I could see our business increasing at that particular, in the fall, because of the cannabis industry, I remember being in the laundromat one day saying, oh my God, I'm completely involved in this because I am benefiting, this business is benefiting from this industry. And then it extrapolated to, well, not only that, that if I'm involved in the drug trade, I'm involved in the tyranny of food trade and the weapons trade, and all of these things started like exploding inside of me to understand just how interconnected everything is, and that I was not outside of that. And I had been living in denial of that in some sort of like, I'm not involved in that. And I wasn't intentionally and directly involved. But I realized so quickly in that moment that there's no way not to be. That we cannot be involved in this economy and live in this world without all of these different industries coming together. It's just how it is. And it was this moment of exploding insight around interconnection. And that we might think we're not involved in this or that, but we all are involved in everything that is happening all around us. So it was a moment of, oh, okay. And I needed to reframe and really think about what is my role in my work? What is the work that I want to be doing? And also this deeper quality of letting go of any sort of idealistic notion of that I had about choosing what I am part of and what I'm not part of. Now, I totally get it about I can be actively and directly involved in certain things, and yet we are indirectly affected by everything. So it was a big moment for me of understanding that interconnection and also finding some compassion for myself around my naivete, and then coming into a clearer understanding of, okay, this is how it is. So what is wise livelihood then? Really, what is wise livelihood? And so the traditional definition from the Buddha is that one should earn a living legally, peacefully, and without coercion or violence, honestly, without trickery or deceit, and in ways that do not entail harm or suffering for others. That's really hard, isn't it? Given what our culture is. We can certainly earn a living legally. That is something that we can certainly do. Watching how coercion or violence, we can do this peacefully. I think it is really true. We can do these things honestly without deceit. This last one is harder in ways that do not entail harm and suffering for others. So this is an imperative in our practice that says do no harm. How to commit to a life of non-harming, which is a very deep intention for me. I don't want to hurt myself and I don't want to hurt others. And there are ways that we cause harm all the time, environmental harm. It happens all the time. I was in a business where people brought in plastic jugs with their soap. Well, what happened to all those plastic jugs? We took them to the recycling. Who knows where they really went? So I'm not trying to pick at, you know, there's so many things that are ungovernable and uncontrollable, but it is about bringing an awareness to all these different aspects of our lives. So the other thing the Buddha said is that there are five specific kinds of livelihood to be avoided. Dealing in weapons, dealing in living beings, including raising farm animals for slaughter. Okay, so what do we do about ranchers and farmers? And again, you know, remembering that this was written 2,600 years ago and primarily for monastics. But even if we take this in, what does wise livelihood mean? We still, I think it's important to consider these things. He said, don't work in meat production, in poisons, in intoxicants, or any occupation. This one is really, I think, poignant. Any occupation that violates right speech or right action is the wrong form of livelihood. So that means that any occupation that uses speech to exploit others, to be harmful, is the wrong form of livelihood. Well, look at our media, right? You know, the media is so much designed to keep us on the outrage, the gerbil wheel of outrage. Say anything, anything goes. It's really harmful. Or right action. These are our precepts. Can we truly commit to continuing to study what non-harming is so we don't intentionally harm? So if that is woven in, if wrong speech and wrong action are woven in, if they're not in line, then it's the wrong form of livelihood. So then let's think about a contemporary definition of what is wise livelihood. What do we do with our time? What do we consume? What are our job choices, housing choices, transportation choices? What do we do with our resources, our money, anything we can share? Gil Fronsdal says, wise livelihood is a practice that cultivates a deep inner sensitivity that simultaneously awakens a greater responsibility for the world while being less weighted down by it. I really appreciate that, because this is big. This is a big piece of practice. So it's a practice that cultivates this deep inner sensitivity while at the same time creates a greater responsibility, but we're not weighted down by it. So that's the balance, right? Like, to be aware of how we spend our time, what we do, to become sensitive to the needs of the world, ourselves and each other. So we have greater responsibility. So we take seriously that what we do matters, but we also don't get paralyzed by it. We can't be, if we're weighted down by it, it's hard to move. It's hard to act. And I think that we all go in and out of that. Things can be so overwhelming and have been. So all these choices that we make around what does it mean to live in line with our values, the inner and outer posture, how that is equated with this inner nobility and interconnectedness and compassion. So the central question for both our jobs and our lives begins with this inner spark. What supports me? What doesn't support me? How can I keep going in that direction? Rumi said, let yourself be silently drawn by the strange pull of what you really love. It will not lead you astray. Isn't that beautiful? Let yourself be silently drawn to the strange pull of what you really love. It will not lead you astray. So sense that thing that is pulling you, that you want to be doing, that you know fills your heart. And it'll be different for each one of us, which is actually really important, because then we have a diversity of what draws people's hearts. And we need all of us. And so then to keep these fundamental questions, does it hurt anybody? Does it help others? Is it meaningful and satisfying? And we can have meaningful, satisfying lives within the context of the Dharma, within the precepts of non-harming, of wise speech, of care, and of love. And if we start with, I love you toes, I love you knees, now we come into that deep sense of self-care. And when we do that for ourselves, we can do it for others. because we're really setting ourselves up in this very wholesome way. So going all the way back to why I had to leave hospital nursing is because I was being destroyed in that. I couldn't find myself in that. So to know deeply enough what supports your well-being and what doesn't, and to let go of what you can let go of and cultivate that deep inner place that is right for you. The artist Lily Yeh said, "I followed my passion and was guided by the light inside me. That light does not belong to me alone. It's innate in all of us. Everyone has it. But more often than not, we choose not to see it." So when my husband said, "You know, you don't have to do this," he saw it and helped me make a different choice and started going in other directions. And when I got involved in the Dharma, I thought, this is where I want to live. This is where I want to be. And it has been completely reliable, this practice of the Dharma. Not always easy, for sure, but it really holds me. And I know, I sense that that's true for many of you too, because we've been doing this together for years. We all keep showing up. "I followed my passion and was guided by the light inside of me. That light does not belong to me alone. It's innate in all of us. Everyone has it." So then how do we take this posture of mind, heart, body, all of it, into our values? And what values do we express through what we do every day? Wendell Berry, and then I'll stop there. He says, "What I stand for is what I stand upon. What I stand for is what I stand upon." So we could go on and on about this topic of wise livelihood connected to interconnectedness and warmth and love and compassion and innate nobility, but we've got 8 minutes left. And I really want to open this up and talk with each other a little bit. So what do you think of all of this?
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.